Welcome. So, today is the 14th of April, 2009. And yesterday, the sun moved into Aries for the coming month. The sun's in Aries from 13th April until 14th May, according to Vedic calculation, not according to Western calculation. In Western astrology, they forget to include the precession of the equinoxes. So they say that the equinox begins on or about March 22nd. That is the beginning of the year when sun enters 0 degrees of Aries. And they just take that as a fixed date each year. But when the earth spins on its axis, it doesn't spin like this. It spins like this. It wobbles. And each year, as we come round to the vernal equinox, the spring equinox, if you do like the sages in India, you line up the signs, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, in the sky, that divide the sky, you line them up with the fixed constellations or star groups behind them. The constellations, as a group, move as well, but they move in relation to each other. Their relationship remains the same. So 0 degrees of Aries lines up to 0 degrees of Ashvini, first
nakshatra,
first constellation, the horse, Ashvini. So that's how you know where to find Aries. Otherwise, you know, things are very, they move out there in space. So because the earth wobbles on the axis, then each year when it comes round to first day of spring or spring equinox, 0 degrees of Aries for the sun, it goes backwards each year, but only 50 seconds. 50 seconds is nothing. Remember, degrees, minutes, seconds, 360 degrees. Each degree has 60 minutes. Each minute has 60 seconds. 50 seconds, who's gonna notice? 50 seconds every year.
Just going backwards.
Backwards. Yeah. So when does it come all the way around? 25,870 years. Full revolution. Right? So where are we now? We are 23 degrees backwards. So if the sun's supposed to enter Aries at on or about 22nd March, March is 30 days, so that's 8, 30 minus 22, that's 8, right? Yesterday it moved, that's 13, 13th. Plus 8 is 21. So 21 days later, which more or less equals 23 degrees and some minutes. That's where the sun is, really. It's gone backwards into the previous sign, Pisces. Who says this? Who believes it? Every astronomer believes it. Every astronomer trained in science knows it's a fact. Vedic astrology knows it's a fact. But every newspaper that says horoscopes, page 42, has no idea.
So Vedic is more current to the...
Oh, yeah.
NASA or...
Well, yeah, I mean, NASA is more according to the Vedic, not the other way around. So that's the reality. So that's why when you think you are a sun sign, you think you're a Cancer, you're probably not. You're probably Gemini. That's why. You see? So when you have this so ingrained in the collective mind, you try to tell people they're a different sign. Some of them, they get angry with you. They don't like that business. But that's how it works. Same is true, not of the sun, of every other planet, and of the ascendant, the rising sign, as well. So the sun entered Aries yesterday, and Mars enters Pisces today. Aries is new beginnings. Good time to start something, as long as it's not a financial endeavor, because Jupiter and Rahu are together. But Sun in Aries is always a good time for adventure and being a trailblazer and a pioneer and doing something new and exciting that hasn't been done before, leading the way. And
that's kind of universal for everybody.
Yeah,
different or different people.
Different people. That's general. I'm being very, very general. And Mars is in Pisces.
But it's coming to the Aries anyway.
Does that mean it softens Mars a bit in Pisces?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a reasonable take on it. Mars is not great in Pisces.
Yeah, because Saturn?
Because Mars is a fire planet and Pisces is a water sign. Right? And Pisces is the subconscious mind. Pisces is what's going on underneath. And when Mars is there, it creates repression of the fire element, anger, frustration, resentment, criticism, blame, guilt, but swallowed, repressed. Instead of speaking and releasing, we go, I'll hold that in there for about 20 years and maybe I'll get a nice disease out of the deal 20 years from now. Cancel that thought. Because that's what happens. So Mars and Pisces, depending what you're applying it to, can be very dangerous. Mars and Pisces is a yoga for a stroke. This is not good. Again, you know, you have to apply it to people specifically, but Mars and Pisces also offers a certain element of danger. It can offer an element of danger in travel, foreign travel, Pisces being foreign countries. So, Kalindi and I have to be careful the next few days. I'm not really worried about it.
What can you use your chance to neutralize?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You definitely can. Can and should. Mars is in Pisces until May 23rd, when it enters Aries. If you have planets in Pisces in your Vedic chart, then Mars is going to start up the boil, put on the kettle and boil them up a little bit. So that can bring impatience and short temper, intolerance, those kinds of things. Depends, it might also motivate you to get some things done that you've been putting off. Depends where it lands in the chart, because it could be just the opposite. You don't want to get out of bed. People with Mars in the 12th house often, they don't do a lot. As little as possible. Pisces, 12th house, same thing. Pisces is the 12th sign. So Mars, the planet of action, is somewhere out there in the subconscious. So it hasn't really come down to Earth. If your Mars is not down on Earth, there's not much going on. You know, are you going to go out and kick the soccer ball around or the football? No. I'll watch footy on TV. It's better. Mars and Pisces. Not that there's anything wrong with watching the football on TV, but if...
The 23rd of May is going to raise his own...
Its own sign.
Its own sign.
Don't you have Mars and Aries?
Yeah.
It's the fireman. You got the fire brigade all in one body right here. Put out the fire. Okay. Any questions about that?
So, hello.
How long does the sun stay in Aries?
Month.
1 month.
Yeah. It's always a month, but give or take. Sun enters Taurus on May 14th. Kalindi's having problems with her breastbone that she broke falling off a horse a year ago. So she's in a Mars period in Cancer. This is Cancer, this area. So this is come inflamed now. That's Mars. We're going through the Bhagavad Gita, the major verses, not all of it, the whole Bhagavad Gita, but just the most important verses. And last week we left off on chapter 2, and this is text 15. This is, you know the Bhagavad Gita? Okay. Well, best among men, Arjuna, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. So, you want to get out of the material world? You don't want to have to take another birth here and be subject to birth, death, old age, and disease, then there's the answer. A person who's not disturbed in happiness or distress is a candidate for liberation. It couldn't be that simple. Apparently it is. Certainly eligible. It's a candidate. Nasato, this is text 16. Nasato vijite bhavo, na bhavo vijite sataha ubhayor apidrishtantas tvanayos. Tattvadarshi Bihi. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent there is no endurance, and of the existent there is no cessation. seers have concluded by studying the nature of both. So the non-existent has no endurance. The impersonalists say that this material world doesn't exist. It's not real. But it does exist on some level because here we are. Because it's temporary or transitory, in that sense, it's not real. Because the only real reality is that which doesn't come to an end. Spirit has no beginning and no end. It's eternally existing. So that's considered to be reality. But even though this is a level of reality, it comes to an end. So therefore, it's in that sense non-existent. At night, if you sleep and you have a dream, sometimes dreams will scare you. Very frightening. It's just a dream. But as far as you're concerned, it's real. If the perception is that it's real, then it's real, at least for that time. Sometimes it isn't. You're not being frightened. Sometimes you're enjoying yourself. I used to have a dream a lot when I was a child that I was playing with all these toys. I had every toy I could possibly want. And I was just about to play with them all. And my mother would wake me up. And I'd have to go to school. And it seemed like it never could actually get to play with them. Because she'd always wake me up. It was time to go to school. I always have this dream at the end of the night, you know, in the morning. Very frustrating for me. But sometimes when you dream, you know it's a dream. You know, sometimes you say, oh God, this is a terrible experience I'm having here. It's a dream. I got to get out of this dream. This is not good at all. You know. So, this seers have concluded by studying the nature of both. Avinashi, this is text 17. Avinashi tatadvidhi yena sarvam midam tatam. Vinasham avyayas yasya nakashjid kartum arhasi arhati. Know that which pervades the entire body is indestructible. No one is able to destroy the imperishable soul. No matter what happens, the soul lives on. It can't be destroyed by any means. So that is because it's the spiritual part, the spiritual spark, and nothing can kill it off. How do we know the soul is present in the body? By the symptom of consciousness. Consciousness. Life. And souls have different degrees of consciousness. Your soul is neither better nor is neither greater nor less than the soul in a blade of grass. The difference is your soul has a much greater consciousness and awareness. So in that sense it's different, which would lead us to conclude from yogic philosophy that your soul is far more developed or evolved because of that level of consciousness. But it's not that in the eyes of God that you are necessarily more precious than the soul in the blade of grass, because it's all part of God's energy. it's all as precious or all as honored or important. Okay. Text 18. Antavanta ime deha nityasyokta sharirinaha anashino prameyasya tasmad yudyasva bharata. Only the material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is subject to destruction. Therefore, fight, O descendant of Bharata. So Arjuna didn't want to fight because his argument was, I'm going to be killing my relatives, friends, teachers, etc. I'm not going to fight. And Krishna was not encouraging him to kill as much as he was encouraging him to do his duty, to behave in accordance with his nature and his varna, his place in life. Varna. Chaturvanyam maya shrishtam. So his varna, his what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah.
Warrior,
yeah. So his duty was simply to do his duty, and in this case it was to fight. A battle based on religious principles, based upon Dharma.
Justice,
virtue. So he wasn't seeing clearly. And he wasn't realizing also that the soul of each of these people will go on. When warriors die on a battlefield, their soul automatically goes to the heavenly realms. That is the result they get for sacrificing themselves on the battlefield. It doesn't matter if what side of the conflict they're on. That doesn't really matter. They all go. Now, if they also have some negative karma, they're also going to have to deal with that. But they still get good karma for having sacrificed themselves.
Does it matter if it's a just war or not?
Yes, they still get good karma for sacrificing themselves for a cause. Because just wars and causes in the material world are open to conjecture. And they're very relative. And none of them are without fault, generally speaking. You know, if you listen to the news coming from the U.S. on the telly, you'd think that the U.S. never did anything wrong in its entire existence. Because that's what they like to think. It can't be so. You know, they don't, not just the U.S., but U.S. is a really good example of they don't really want to own their stuff. Not really. I mean, they do a lot of charitable work in the world. And so, that's good. But, you know, everybody has some flaw. Like, this fire is covered by smoke. That's the flaws that take place here in the material world, no matter what you do. Every endeavor is covered by some fault. Bhagavad Gita. As fire is covered by smoke, as a mirror is covered by dust. So, yeah, even the guy gives up his life on the battlefield. You could say the Iraqis who invaded Kuwait. They up and invaded Kuwait back in when it was 91 or something. Unprovoked. Killed a bunch of people. Stole a bunch of stuff. And occupied the country. And said, Kuwait was originally part of us and we're taking it back now. The Iraqis, this is not a just war, we could argue. It's not a just war. The Iraqis that got killed in the battlefield will go to heaven, will go to a higher place. because of sacrificing their lives. Now, what else their karma might afford them, who knows?
Could you say the same for suicide bombers?
Well, you see, a suicide bomber, that's not the battlefield.
They would argue that they are...
They would argue all they want. But you see, this is talking about Kshatriya code, warrior code, where combatants come together in a place designated for battle. Not people going into a marketplace filled with civilians and detonating a bomb. That is not an example of chivalry and warrior code. So no, you can't say the same for that.
They don't fight like they used to do.
Yeah, you see, there's, if you study the Vedas, you'll find out there's a code. Like, you don't stab a guy in the back. You don't fight an unarmed man. You wait for him to pick up his sword. You give him a chance to pick up his sword. You don't fight a man who's fleeing, who's running away. You don't shoot arrows at him. You don't throw axes at him. You don't throw grenades at him if he's fleeing. You don't do anything to somebody who surrendered to you, surrendered himself. This is a code.
That seems very fair.
Hmm?
To the woman as well, like,
you know, you got women that are in military uniforms, so that sort of complicates things. You're not supposed to attack women, children, and old people, and they're out of bounds. You just don't do it, you know. But if some woman in uniforms coming at you to attack you, then I don't know.
Okay.
Complicates things. It's Kali Yuga. It's the Iron Age, you know. Yes, I know that the suicide bombers think they're doing the right thing, but they're following no warrior code. That act in and of itself is an act of cowardice. So you want to fight somebody, then you fight them on equal terms. And you say, I don't like you, I'm going to fight with you, I'm going to challenge you. Okay, then okay, that's fine. The whole thing about challenging. I challenge you to a duel. Remember, in the old days it used to be a duel. Take off the gloves, smack the guy. How dare you smack me? Pistols at noon. You know. Yeah, exactly. And you'll give your handkerchief to your champion. Yeah, exactly.
But even according to, I have some Muslim friend, right? And they said even in their Quran, it says that, like, you know, this is actually not allowed. Suicide is totally prohibited in there.
Well, suicide is against any religious code there is. I mean, I know you can argue in favor of suicide. So, you know, even if, supposing they go and they get 72 virgins and they live in heaven for a while, they're still going to have to pay the debt for the suicide and for killing innocents.
If you have more bad karma, you get the good karma first. Isn't that it?
Yeah. The Vedas say that when you die, whatever your preponderance of karma is, if you've got, like, you know, 90% good karma coming to you, 10% negative karma, then you will get the 10% negative karma first. And you will suffer that in some hellish existence or hellish experience. And when that has been burned off or paid off, then you will get the 90% good karma. So you got something to look forward to as they're, you know, boiling you in hot oil or whatever they do. Yeah, and vice versa. And that's demonstrated or discussed very clearly in the Mahabharata. And it makes sense. And get your negative karma out of the way.
And the negative karma must get us to come back to earth, because if we're a soul, you can't put hot water on a soul up in some.
Well, you have to understand that heaven and hell is, in that sense, a state of mind, no?
Mm. Yeah. Well, hell could be coming back as an animal. You're brought down a notch or two.
Yeah, it's a state of mind, you know. Just, again, if you're having a dream and you're being chased and somebody's trying to kill you, what's that? And you're scared, you know, scared out of your wits. But you're sleeping comfortably in bed. It's only a state of mind, isn't it? Najayate mriyate va kadachin nayam bhutva bhavita va nabuya ajo nitya shashvato yam purano nanyate hanyamane sharire. Text 20. For the soul, there is never birth, nor death, nor having once been, does he ever cease to be. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. So he's talking about, he uses the word slain because Arjuna is about to slay people. So the soul is not slain. No matter what you do, can't kill him off. Text 22. Vasakshi jirnani yatavihaya navani granati naroparani tata shirirani vihaya jirnani anyani sanyati navani dehi. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old and useless ones, similarly, the soul accepts new material bodies, giving up old and useless ones. It's that simple. When a body wears out, get rid of it. Why do you want to keep hanging out in it? Some people say, well, no, you know, this is my favorite shirt, or my favorite pajamas, or my favorite trousers. But they got holes in them. I know, but I like them. They're comfortable. You know, it fits me right now. Or whatever. And they're sometimes falling off their body. They don't want to get rid of them. So, by the same token, when the body becomes worn out, don't be so attached to it. Don't try to desperately hang on to it no matter what. Well, I can have a quintuple bypass and I can get stents put into my legs to clear out my blood clots.
Yeah, well, before you get to that point, you should be looking after your clothes.
Yeah, well, I know that, but I'm just saying. And I can get a couple of transplants, and I'm on the list for a new liver. Yeah. So I can start drinking all over again at the pub.
We did a first full face transplant in France last week. 2 weeks.
I think it was a half a face.
New
face, they're doing face transplants now. But they give you somebody else's face and hands, they give them new hands and mouth.
One woman who had the first surgery a couple of years ago, she said it took 3 years for her to get used to looking in the mirror and seeing someone else's face, and she didn't recognize it of herself.
But if you've got someone else's cells,
yeah,
as part of your body, you know, where does that leave you?
I was working in the lab late one night. So it's a little bit of a Dr. Frankenstein. That's what I think. anyway, you know, don't be so attached. You get another body. The reason they're so frantic to do this is because they think they have only one life. And they got to hang on to it, no matter what. Some people are so desperate to have a baby, they'll do anything to have a baby, rather than accept the fact that this lifetime they're not meant to have a baby. You know, they'll get a surrogate person, and then they'll get in lawsuits with the surrogate. And I have so many clients, well, quite a few clients, who are trying to adopt in third world countries. And believe me, I have gone through all their stuff with them and all the shenanigans they're trying to pull in these adoption agencies in these third world countries, and trying to cover up the child's health history, and on and on and on. If you realize that you have as many lifetimes as you need, you don't have to cram it all in to one lifetime. Boy, I feel relief just thinking about it. No, I mean, why can't they just accept? Why can't you just accept that, you know, in this part of your life, things are quite nice. You have what you want, and that's part of your life. They're not, and it's okay. It's all right. And you don't have to go to the fertility clinic 15 times. Maybe you go once or twice, and it's okay. Look at this lady now. And they call her Octomom. That's what they're calling her, because she had the 8 babies. And she's not married, and she what? Has already 2 babies. And she has no job, she has no money.
6 already.
Oh, 6 already. Excuse me. I lost track. I didn't have my counter with me.
If that's not a need still within herself, she might nurture. So instead of like nurturing herself, like she just doesn't go out there to nurture others.
I think it's a need to be recognized desperately. So now she's negotiating for her own reality TV show. Of course. And the cameras will follow her around with her octo babies. And while she's busy trying to find a man who'll marry her and become the proud father of her 52 children, or however many she has.
And could that, you know, if she didn't have any children, you know, say you weren't meant to have children, it strikes me that there's a couple of things. It's like it's so controlling that you want what you want, no matter what.
Isn't that our society?
Yeah. But the other part of it is, I'm wondering, if you went through life without having a child, if that was what you were meant to experience in this life, would that not be better karmically?
I don't understand the last part. What would be better karmically?
Like
if you didn't have what you weren't supposed to have.
Yeah. To accept all things, to be able to accept that, well, I'm not going to have any children.
Yeah, it would be better karmically. Because if you're trying at any cost, by any means, to induce something to happen in your life, when it kind of hasn't happened in a reasonable and natural manner, then you could be creating all kinds of problems for yourself.
You're forcing a soul to come in too.
Well, this lady forced 8 souls to come in. Who did she hoodwink to get 8 fetuses left in her womb?
But did she have fertility?
Did she have fertility? Are you kidding me? Oh yeah, she had fertility. She had them all planted in the womb. But you're only supposed to have 2 planted. But this doctor, I think he's an Indian guy. Some guy that she knew because she worked at these clinics. She worked at fertility clinics. I think she's in her 20s, isn't she?
but they were saying that what was like, you know, end of day, she's gonna get, go on the benefits and gonna get the all the taxpayers' money, and they say the people are talking about.
Yeah, you get $100 for every kid or whatever.
But she can't justify to giving the love to all these kids. So how's she gonna do it?
It's her desperation for love and recognition that's fueling all this. She tried to sell the story to some magazine for $1 million. Just like you do when you're a new mother. You run around trying to get your story sold, don't you? Okay. So, giving up the old and useless bodies. The soul can never be cut into pieces by any weapon, nor can it be burned by fire, nor moistened by water, nor withered by the wind. This individual soul is unbreakable, insoluble, and can be neither burned nor dried. He's everlasting, all-pervading, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, immutable, and unchangeable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. When you think of it like that, if you finally decide you're going to take off that wonderful pair of pajamas that you've loved for so long, they're now falling off your body, and you take them off, and you throw them in the bin, and then do you go off and have a good cry? No. I know there's a little more to it than that, but effectively, that's what you've just done. You've given up an old and useless body. You've given up an old and useless outfit or pair of pajamas. For one who has taken his birth, death is certain. And for one who is dead, birth is certain. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. There are examples of souls who have been raised up to higher realms in this body. But do not think that this is common practice, because it isn't. The vast majority of people, this will not apply to. You'd have to be a soul of such magnitude, such purity, such virtue, such light, for that to happen. Making an ascension has become quite popular in some circles in this lifetime. Yeah, I mean, in our world, to ascend while in the body, well, to ascend in spirit, that's one thing, which would be, you know, that's possible. But to ascend in the very same body, not very likely. And if you're more than 25 years of age, why would you want that body? It says in the Vedas that demigods, which are equivalent to angels and archangels in the Christian pantheon, are 25 years of age, and they never change. They do not age, and their age that they appear is 25. Even though they may be hundreds or thousands of years old, their age is 25. You know? Yeah. Now, if you told me I could look like I was when I was 25, I'd say, cool. Because I was far more happy with my body at 25 than I am with my body at almost 60. So, why would you want to ascend, no offense, ladies and gentlemen, in that bag of bones, when if you left that bag of bones behind, you could go into your light body again. Right? I mean, this is very simple logic. So the gods appear eternal at 25. Krishna appears 16 years of age. He's eternally 16. Even when he's 100 and something, he looks like 16. So even 25 was too old for him. Ram was. Well, yeah, Ram would have lived older, but I don't think he would have aged much, no, being Vishnu. That's usually a tip-off. Oops. How come you're not aging? Well, it's actually... Yeah, that's that. I can tell you, but you'd have to change bodies.
Do you notice that humans look younger when they're doing the practice that they're meant to do?
Yeah, absolutely. When humans are following their hearts, they will be happy and they will look younger longer. And they'll stay younger longer and they'll stay healthier longer. That is absolutely true. That's almost a no-brainer. I don't know why people can't figure that out. When they're doing stuff that is, makes them unhappy or isn't part of their dharma, isn't part of their natural tendency, or they're under duress or pressure, or they don't like their boss, or they don't like their job, you want to age quickly? That's how you do it. That's the secret.
John and Karina... called.
He called here?
No. What was his name?
Oh, Babaji.
Yeah, did he have another name? Just Babaji.
Babaji, yeah.
He was living with him in an ashram, or John was anyway, for about 25 years or something. And the guy at that stage was 120. And he see photographs of him, he looks like he's 20.
Wow.
And then all the, they were all told in the ashram you had to go, and then they were all sent back, and he disappeared. The guru disappeared.
Well, he's a very accomplished yogi.
Yeah, right.
90 tall.
Yeah.
90 tall. Oh, yes, that's him.
Babaji. Babaji Mahashai. 90 tall up in the Himalayas foothills.
Yeah, he turns up.
Exactly.
He's a really, really beautiful looking guy.
Do thou fight for the sake of fighting, without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat, and by so doing you shall never incur sin. Sin means negative karmic reaction. Sukkaduke same kritva labha labhao jaya jayao tato yudhayo yudhaya yujasva naivam papam avapsisi. Text 38. Do thou fight for the sake of fighting without considering happiness or distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat, and by so doing you shall never incur sin. So that means do your duty. Well, I'm only going to do my duty if I win. Well, you don't know if you're going to win or not. You just do your duty. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Sometimes things work out, sometimes they don't. It doesn't matter. It's not the point. You're not working for a goal. You work toward a goal, but you're not working for a goal. You're working for the work, for the service. in this endeavor, he's talking about yoga practice. In this endeavor, there is no loss or diminution, and a little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. So whatever you do in terms of acting in a spiritual manner, and suppose you act in a spiritual manner for 5 years, and then you say, ah, the heck with this, I'm not doing this anymore. Like you said earlier, sometimes just wish I didn't have this knowledge. It's just a pain to deal with all these other people. Well, yeah, I've heard that like at least 100 times in my life, if not more. There's a burden that comes with this kind of knowledge. And then you have to deal with all the other people who don't get it, don't see it, don't want to see it, don't believe it, think it's a bunch of hogwash. And you know, you don't have kindred spirits to discuss it with. And so even if you act in a conscious manner for 5 years and then throw it all in and say, I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm going to go back to my wicked and far more enjoyable ways, there's still no loss or diminution for what you've done. The value will be there. And the benefit will be there.
That's just the same as it's opposite. Like the other side of the coin. That, you know, what bad deeds you've done as well, that doesn't just go away either.
No, it does.
Does it?
It does. Your spiritual practice reduces your negative karma. It burns it up. That's what it does. It does make it go away. You don't have to suffer things or experiences that you're destined to suffer when you perform regulated spiritual practice. It will burn off that negative karma. That's one of its benefits.
Yeah, I think I've expressed it badly, what I'm trying to say, and I don't know what the words are for it.
Yeah. It's just like if you do something heinous and you feel genuine remorse for it, you're very sorrowful that you did it. That does a lot to remove the negative reaction. Sometimes in court, somebody will do something. Maybe somebody has a few drinks and he's driving and then he kills somebody in the car. Well, that man didn't mean to do that. And, you know, it breaks his heart that he's done such a horrendous thing and created so much grief for the family and killed the guy off. And the person is absolutely distraught that he's done this and very, very genuinely remorseful. That has a lot, it does a lot to remove his negative karma. Because his attitude is correct. It's exactly the right attitude. Rather than these other guys, you know, go to a prison and interview all the convicts. What are you in for? Are you guilty? Nah, they got the wrong guy. They stitched me up, they framed me. Most all of them will tell you that. So, no remorse in that case. But spiritual practice removes all that stuff. If you're sincere, if you've got a good heart, not if you're a conniver. And the universal witnesses, sun god, the wind god, god of death, all these different deities and forces, they know. You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. The sun god is always looking on down. I changed the words a bit. The sun is the witness. In the minds of those who are too attached to sense enjoyment and material opulence, and who are bewildered by such things, the resolute determination of service to God does not take place. In the minds of those who are too attached to sense enjoyment and material opulence, material things, and who are bewildered by such things. In other words, they can't think straight because they're just wrapped up in enjoying themselves or acquiring things. The resolute determination of service to God does not take place. Become resolute and determined to serve God. That won't happen. In other words, you'll never take to a spiritual path with any seriousness, with any resolution, or with any determination if you're still too attached to material things and material sense enjoyment. You know, we had dinner the other day, Easter. One person said, a younger person, said, you know, I'm really thinking about becoming a vegetarian. I brought a vegetarian chili that I made. So the person said, I'm really seriously thinking about becoming a vegetarian. I said, oh yeah. And then they said, but it's too hard to find, you know, good food. Which is true. Or they said, or if you don't know how to cook it, then what? Which is also true, you know. Because you don't want to eat just boiled broccoli all the time.
Pasta.
Or pasta all the time. So, and I said, well, part of the problem is, and the person said, oh, but I love meat so much. I said, yeah, well, you're addicted to meat. You know, or we become addicted to enjoying it. And we, you know, we're really, it's an addiction. Yeah, I know, because I used to have that addiction. And to give it up is very, very difficult when you have that addiction, or that, if you don't want to call it an addiction, it's conditioning. So then we sat down to have the dinner, and this person went for the meat like there was no tomorrow. Went for the lamb that was being offered on Easter Sunday, the sacrificial lamb. I don't know what the lamb thought of it all, but so then the vegetarian chili was being passed around, and it was offered to this person. Oh, no, 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 I don't want that. And I was at the other end of the table, and I said, well, I thought you wanted to become a vegetarian. Oh, yeah, well.
Not to make.
Yeah, exactly, you know. I said, well, why don't you try the dish? You know, try it. No, 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 no. I can only have the meat and the potatoes. Okay. All right. So this is a classic example of being addicted to sense gratification. The most powerful of all the senses. Everybody thinks it's the genital, but it's not. It's the tongue. It's the tongue that leads you around by the nose. Because the tongue has a dual purpose. It talks and it eats. So it's ambidextrous. And it'll get you in trouble in both ways. You know. The Vedas mainly deal with the subject of the three modes of material nature. What are they? Sattva, goodness. Rajas, passion or desire. And tamas, or ignorance, darkness, or delusion. Everybody's caught up in these three modes if you're in the material world. Rise above these modes, O Arjuna. Be transcendental to all of them. Be free from all dualities and from all anxieties for gain and safety. It's interesting words. And be established in the self. I don't know if it says that. Gain and safety. Free from the anxieties for gain and safety. Gain is trying to get your sense desires met. Safety is what you pointed out at the beginning. Play it safe. As soon as you tell them about Vasu and they tell you they just built an eco home and all the doors are facing south, which means at the very least their marriages are going to fall apart. Guaranteed. But at least they're going to fall apart in the sunshine. Yeah, you know. So safety means to not fall under attack by others. To attack you because you're challenging. You see, as soon as you start challenging people's fundamental belief, they get really angry. You know, we were talking on Sunday about meat eating. I didn't bring it up. Other people brought it up, so we talked about it. We weren't beating anybody over the head about it. We were just talking about it. Sometimes people get extremely defensive when you just talk about these things. Yeah. And people just soon play it safe. Gain safety. So you won't be criticized. So you won't be made to feel like an outsider. You know, why don't you just be one of us? Why don't you just have a beer and have a steak and shut up?
And a fag.
And a fag. You know.
I think over time, though, if you just drop little ones, this is the case with me. They think I'm a looper, but we all still get along. And it comes to the point where they expect it of me. So it's, you know, it's just her. And
yeah, but you can handle it. Some people can handle it and some people can't. I can handle it as well, but not everybody can.
As long as you do it in sort of a, you know, a light-hearted way, rather than throwing people out asking your belief.
When you're detached from, not setting up to convince anybody with anything.
Exactly.
I think that's
right. You have some knowledge. If the subject comes up, you can share it. You're not attached to whether that person does it or not. So therefore, there's no conflict. There's no underlying need to prove. I remember I had dinner many years ago with this lady in L.A. It's a very nice lady. And she had some friends that were vegetarians that she had been hanging around with. And I had been a vegetarian for a long time, so I sat down and I ordered a vegetarian dish and she ordered, I don't know what she ordered, I think she ordered fish or something. And she was waiting for me to attack her. She says, yeah, I know, I know. I'm eating meat. And I said, yeah, and what's your point? And I'm a bad person, right? And I said, no, I thought you were a really nice person. That's why I came out to dinner with you. Oh, you do? She said, yeah. Well, don't you think I'm bad because I'm eating? I said, no. Well, that's what all my vegetarian friends tell me. I said, well, that's too bad. They're not very much of friends then, are they? But she came under attack so often that she had an inferiority complex. She had a whole complex developed. I never said a word to her. I didn't give her a funny look. I wasn't even thinking about it. All right. Any questions? It could, depending what ashram it is, and having lived in an ashram, it depends. You know, ashram life can be very pleasant at times and very challenging at times.
Sometimes your own apartment is a good place to start.
Sometimes your own apartment is your safest ashram. Depends, you know. But ashrams, I suppose, in the scheme of things, whoever's there and whoever challenges you, and that's part of the whole reality. You know, the problem with ashrams, the good part of ashrams is it's a place full of like-minded people who all want the same thing. They want to live a yoga lifestyle of meditation, spiritual practice. The downside is that they think they're advanced. That's the downside of being in an ashram. You've got people there who are not very advanced at all, but think they are. And that sometimes is problematic, I've experienced. It takes a long time to become spiritually advanced. 2.5 days of Reiki training, you become a Reiki master. So that's, you know, that's the fastest master program I've ever heard. I don't know anybody can master anything in 2.5 days. Friday evening, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. You might be introduced to Reiki, but I doubt that you mastered it. By the same token, it takes a long time to become a master, no matter what it is.
You were talking like in the advanced spiritually, because in the Vedas sometimes the people get too much knowledge, they get to bring the pride into self and
yeah,
they think
exactly
the other, and they say no, you're just back to square again to zero.
That's right. Yeah. As soon as you think you're advanced, that proves you're not advanced, because then the ego has entered again. So the whole idea is to drive out the ego. Oh, look how good I was at driving out the ego. The ego's back. You got you. You're finished.
Yeah.
That's it.
What happened to Vishnu Mitra?
Yeah.
Fighting against
Vasishtha. Steal his cow.
Yeah.
Give me that cow.
Yeah.
I want to take that cow. And
He couldn't
get the Rishi to fight with him. And the Vishvamitra was a sage who had been a warrior, had been a king, and stopped being a warrior king and became a sage. But he still had the warrior in him. So he goes to see Vasishtha, who had been a sage forever, very advanced. And Vasishtha had a Kamadhenu cow, wish-fulfilling cow. The cow would give anything you want. The cow could provide, including cooked food, anything, jewels, doesn't matter. So Vishvamitra arrived with his retinue, you know, so maybe 200 people, his followers. Here we are. or hungry. No problem. And the cow provided. It's a fabulous 10-course meal. Cooked to perfection. And Vishwamitra said, this is absolutely wonderful, wonderful food. Who's made this? He's got it from the cow. The wish-fulfilling cow. Touchstone cow. Chintamani. Where'd you get such a cow? Yoga practice? Oh. Okay. I am taking this cow. No, it's my cow. Well, you should be detached. Don't be attached to a cow. I'm taking this cow with me. And he says, no, you better leave the cow here. No, I'm taking the cow. He puts a rope around the cow's neck. He starts to take the cow. Vasishtha doesn't say anything. He sits there calmly, looks. And finally the cow goes, aren't you going to defend me? He's taking me away. I want to live with you. Why are you letting him take me? And Vasishtha knows that his power lies in Brahman, lies in being spiritual. If he gives up his spiritual behavior, which is to remain detached and kind and accepting and understanding, then he gives up his dharma. Once he gives up his dharma, he's finished. His power leaves him. He has no power. So it appears as though he was doing nothing, only sitting. Why don't you stand up and fight, the cow says, and defend me? But all the while, he's practicing his dharma. So the cow becomes enraged. How dare this guy take me away against my will? And immediately produces a whole army. The cow. To protect herself. And the army wipes out Vishvamitra and all the gang. Well, he doesn't kill Vishvamitra, but he drives them off. The army drives them off and away they go. Okay, you can have your cow, and away they go. I think that's the way it is.
He didn't ask the cow to be to manifest the army.
No.
So he didn't become violent, and he didn't deviate from his path.
Right. He didn't deviate from his path. He didn't say, go and kill these guys, because that wasn't his dharma. His dharma. So the cow says, why did I have to do this? Manifest this. He says, that's why. I had to stay in my dharma. And the cow says, well, what if the result would have been different? He says, but it wasn't different. The result was exactly what I wanted the result to be. You're here. I'm here. And I didn't have to compromise my dharma. So his power was in sustaining his dharma. His nature and his practice. And what they tried to do was pull him out of that. And that he would have lost the cow if he would have then started to fight and tried to defend the cow. Because that's not his dharma.
Because he was Brahma Rishi, like a supreme sage.
Supreme sage.
Yeah, and then that's why his dharma is not detached with the things.
Yeah.
Because the other one, Vishwamitra, he was like, he thinks that his ego was like, you know, I done all the Vedas, I know all the mantras, everything, and I can do anything, right?
Yeah.
If this guy, how could be this guy is better than me, right? And I should have this cow.
I should have the cow.
So he just kind of detached. Once he detached, so that's ego. Once the ego comes, he just...
Right. So his own ego defeated him. That's another way to look at it. So you apply that to here, Krishna is telling Arjuna. Arjuna is saying to Krishna, I'm going to go to the forest and meditate. I'm going to sit down and put out a nice piece of kusha grass on the ground. I'm going to meditate. Krishna, yeah, good luck, buddy. Time is an hour. Was your meditation finished? That was half an hour. You wouldn't be able to do it. This is warrior dharma. Stick to what you know. Be true to your dharma. And so Vasishtha's Brahma Rishi power was in letting the thing unfold. Now, what he was doing in the meantime within himself in creating his own reality or sustaining his reality was, that's my cow, the cow stays. Well, what happened? It stayed. And all he did was sit there. There you go. Okay, so we're going to practice a little Vasishtha Dharma now. A little meditation. Take key, okay, please. Okay, close your eyes. Breathe, relax, let go, deeply relax, allow the stress, tension, fear, and apprehension to drain from your body, totally, completely relax. Breathe. Let go. High above, a beautiful beam of radiant, pearl white light comes down from the heavens. Down, down, all the way down. Entering through the top of your head, expanding. Throughout your head, your torso, your arms, your legs. Out the bottom of your feet. Into the earth below. Breathe, relax. And let go. All right. You're out in nature, sitting quietly, maybe walking along. And there's somebody approaching you. Now, you're not quite sure if you can trust this person or not. Don't know them. Or maybe you do know them, but you're still not sure if you can trust them. And the person arrives next to you, and they have a proposition for you, something they would like you to do. And they say it's of great benefit to you. Has this benefit and this benefit and this benefit. But in order to do it, you have to compromise one of your principles. What do you have to compromise? What will you have to do that you don't really want to do? You tell this person, if I do this, what you're asking, I will have to compromise, sacrifice this principle, my belief, or my behavior. when you tell them this, they argue against. They tell you that compromising it is okay. It's no problem. Because of the benefits you will gain. You should compromise it. Don't worry about it. It's not important. What do you do? What is the outcome? What happens? How does the person react? How do you feel? Continue until you've finished all these steps. When you've finished, return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, at peace. Thank you. Om Tat Sat. Hare Krishna. Marcus Shmika will be here on the 27th of April. He'll be speaking at Still Oregon Park Hotel, Monday, 27th, 8 o'clock, on creating wealth in your life, in your home, your business. Using Vasati or Vastu principle. And that's a Monday night to Tuesday night. He's going to, I think we're going to be here, I'm not sure yet, but he's going to introduce the time waiver healing system.
And it might be here, special
session. Yeah, I know, we're not going to get a hotel for that.
Depends on how many people are interested.
Depends on how many people are interested. Oh, we have to get some flyers together, which we haven't done yet.
And also, that Dr. Marcel, what's his name? Message to Walter guy.
Yeah. We got the tickets for that.
Did you get
it? Yeah, June 1st in Kilkenny. Mm-hmm. He's speaking.
What is he doing?
He speaks about
the Japanese guy, the messages in water. When you put vibrations in water and the crystals, how the crystals form.
Yeah.